Good evening. This is May 20th, 2010, James McCanney with my Science Hour, going right into the show. And a quick comment, last week I failed to get my archive up on my homepage, and so I'm sorry for that. A lot of people depend on that for listening to the show, and that will be corrected in the future. So those little things do pop up now and then. But things have been there have been many things in change, let's put it that way. Some new systems going in, some new changes, some old equipment going out, and a lot of activity going on, so those kind of slip-ups can happen. But this just in off the wire, and I'm amazed I caught this for the show tonight. 6:10 p.m. this was actually posted on the internet, and I was surfing around, just happened to grab it. Herschel telescope, which is of course one of the new very high powered telescopes in outer space, it says unveils icy debris ringing sunlight stars, and it goes on to call it a donut shaped ring. I always get a kick out of this, how they just slide these in with articles in the news media, and then supposedly this will be followed by an article in Astronomy and Astrophysics, one of the astrophysics journals, the so-called respectable peer-reviewed. But let me explain this. Let me go back a few steps for people who are not 100% familiar with my work. And when I was at Cornell University in the late 1970s, early 1980s, I made a number of major predictions. And one of them was that eventually we would see other stars with donut-shaped nebulae around them. These are gas and dust clouds that surround these stars, including our own. And so these are sun-like stars, stars very much like our own sun, at a distance not too far away in our own galaxy, and they're able to see these with very powerful telescopes and in the infrared wavelengths, which allows them to see extremely cold material out in outer space. So now they're actually discovering these rings around other stars. And so, as I said, this was one of my main predictions back then, and I even called it a donut-shaped ring or nebula. And I talked about how the comets would use this as sources of material as they work their way into the solar system. And so now these have actually been discovered, and just in the last day or two, May 19th, May 20th, is the quoting of these debris disks have been seen. And now, of course, what you find is the standard explanation coming in saying, well, this is like the Kuiper Belt, where they see some planets out there, and then they're I call it the creeping crud. It's the way science adapts new information into its old theoretical structure. I call it the creeping crud. And so now they have to adapt to new material, which really doesn't make sense in their world, because the planets all were supposed to have formed billions of years ago. So why is there still vast amounts of material floating around these stars, enough to see from our own distant star back here near planet Earth? But the thing I want to point out for those people who've really followed my work closely is that they're calling these donut-shaped rings, and as I say, they consist of sand and grain dust material and also gases. And so these were just discovered. But that confirms the proposition that I had to make, the assumption, because it could not have been detected in the late 1970s with equipment that was available then. There had to be a source of material out there for comets to form, and of course, comets are not dirty snowballs. They are an electrical discharge of the solar capacitor, which attracts this material and brings it in, and when these cometary objects are captured into our solar system. Some of them, very few of them, become larger and eventually can become moons or planets in the solar system. And there's good evidence of historical evidence that one such event happened, a major one, that extracted the oceans and atmosphere off of Mars. So I doubt if these researchers will quote my article, which was also published in a very similar astrophysical journal. But, of course, they will be put on notice about this. But they tend to kind of feign away from it or stay away from it, because then they would have to admit that, gee, somebody, first of all, predicted this long ago, but mainly based on theoretical work that's very different, not based on the standard axioms of astronomy. So, anyway, I'm not going to belabor that, but I just thought that was interesting. And I've noticed that, too. Many people have noticed that these postings will go on the Internet very closely, either before or after my show, so that I can't include them on my show for the news for the upcoming week. At any rate, and that goes along with another posting that actually was just updated about an hour ago. And here we have the Mars rovers. I think most people are familiar with those, these little robot little machines that they have on Mars moving around, and they, of course, have solar panels. They can absorb solar energy to convert it to electricity, and they've been running up there for thousands of days. What this number here, 2,245 days they've been working on Mars, moving around, exploring, digging, taking pictures, and sending back information. But the picture that is in front of me right now that was just posted, this is on MSNBC. You could go there and look in the science and technology subsection of MSNBC on the Internet, and it would show the pictures of some tracks. Now, one of the rovers is following the other rover, so you see these tracks, but wouldn't you think that scientists would say, gee, Mars is covered with dust, and there are severe dust storms on Mars every year. Annually, we see them. They're so severe we can see them from Earth. That's how severe the Martian dust storms are. But you can see pristine riverbeds, riverbeds that are just like the day that the atmosphere and water left, all over the surface of Mars. Now, wouldn't this raise a contradiction in your mind if you were a well-trained PhD planetary scientist and say, well, gee, how could we have these rovers driving around in all this dust and dirt, which covers the entire planet? We know that the rovers have actually been shut down due to severe dust storms that have nearly covered them, and they have to wait until they can kind of shake off or something to get going again, to get enough sunlight to where they can move and continue gathering sunlight. So they certainly know that this activity is going on, yet is in absolute total contradiction with the appearance of the surface of Mars, which is fresh, pristine, just like the day that the oceans and atmosphere left, which would tell you, if you had any reasonable sense of intelligence or childlike in curiosity, it would tell you that Mars lost its ocean and atmosphere very recently. So how could that possibly be in a solar system where they say that everything is 4.5 billion years old? Very interesting. So at any rate, a couple quick postings that came out just before this show went on the air, so I thought I would lead in with those. People have been asking me to comment on the oil spill. And oh, by the way, before I forget it, the main science topic I'll be talking about Jupiter tonight, which is a small star, not really a planet, in our solar system. And so I'll be talking about that because it has lost one of its bands, one of its major colorful bands, the Southern Equatorial Belt, just kind of disappeared about a week ago. So people want to know about that. So I'll be talking about that. Also, I was just informed as I was waiting in queue for the show to start that the frequency of this show will change 58 minutes into the show. So I will end it 1 minute early tonight at 58 minutes, just so that we get the ending of the show in, because most people are not going to be able to switch over to the nighttime frequency. At any rate, just to give you a little heads up on why the show will end a little bit early this evening, about a minute early. Okay, oil spill commentary. What can I add to what's already been said? We're talking about big government agencies, these people who are not elected, they're somehow hired into positions, and we always think, well, we elect our government. Well, it's really not true. There are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people working in the federal government, in agencies, in bureaus, in think tanks, and they have far more influence on the government than the government itself, probably. But you have these agencies which allow this type of terrible, shoddy work to go on. Big business is, of course, involved. So incompetence, greed, stupidity, lack of respect for the earth and its inhabitants. What more can you say? This is the name of the game. This is what's going on today. The governments are simply not responsible. And then after the event, don't you think with the thousands and thousands of oil wells that we have underwater drilling or surface drilling out in the Gulf of Mexico, that they would have already had in place some kind of a safety mechanism for some such accident? The rigs set up high, we have hurricanes that come through the Gulf, this type of accident was just waiting to happen. So, once again, all you can say is incompetence, greed, stupidity, lack of respect for the earth. What more can you say? And also, this has just come out today. Let me look for the article. It turns out that a number of scientists, after this spill occurred, or the breach in the pipe system after the fire on the oil drilling platform, and then the subsequent breach in the piping system that brings it up to the surface, some scientists began to analyze the satellite data and other information that was available, and the official NOAA estimate is that 5,000 barrels a day of oil are being lost into the ocean. These scientists are saying that's not correct. It's more like 15 times that. 15 times that. About 80,000 barrels a day leaking into the ocean. Much of it, I don't know the exact percentage, which stays at the bottom. And then, of course, the lighter oil that floats to the surface of the ocean. And, of course, shutting down the entire Gulf of the United States right now. Fishing is just impossible. It's just an absolute world-scale disaster. And but there again, the absolute irresponsibility of these government agencies, and weeks go by where they're simply unable to do anything about this situation in the Gulf. Just an absolute disaster of a worldwide scale. Some people at first tried to compare it to the Valdez accident where the ship ran up on a small outcropping of rock up in the Alaska Straits. And then, of course, much of that hit local islands and was absorbed there. But this spill is covering, this eventually will cover the entire Gulf of Mexico, and if they cannot cap it, soon it will start hitting the Atlantic ocean current waves, both under the sea and both under the ocean and on the surface. And this oil is going to start to go everywhere. So, like I say, an absolute worldwide catastrophe. There's not a lot I can comment. Many people want to know if I believe this is due to nefarious activity by our international banking groups, that type of thing. I don't know. It seems very suspicious. There's evidence that major investors in oil shorted oil the day before it happened. So all kinds of activity going on that would indicate that, yeah, a few people knew that this was going to happen or something was going to happen. Another quick comment just on the economic issues, which I try and stay away from, but these are issues that are somewhat local here where I happen to live, so I wanted to bring this up by noting that many companies are starting to dump their health insurance benefits for employees, which would, of course, only push this into the national system. These employees, that's one of the few good benefits that is left with many of these companies, to have health care. And as I've always said, the health of a country is related to the health of its people. So if a company does not care enough for its people to keep them healthy, it does not care at all about those people. And the same with the nation. The health care program that's being put in place can only fail because we're not set up. We're set up on an economic system, and we do not have the medical resources to actually maintain the number of people in this country. I've talked about that before. Just another quick commentary here. The Miami Herald today, there was an article, front page of the business section, that said that the prime rate mortgages are failing in huge numbers. 1 in 10 homeowners, and these are in the prime rate, top rate mortgage securities and mortgages, that 1 in 10 homeowners is behind in payments. 37% of new foreclosures, well over one-third of new foreclosures, is by the rich and well-secured property owners. These are the people that could get a loan for just about any house. 37% of foreclosures are within this group. So the final countdown is at hand with the economy as we head into the summer of 2010. And this story is local, so many people may not have seen this. But it's worth noting, retirement accounts are folding, or retirement benefit accounts are folding all over the country and all over the world where they exist. They're going belly up. But now there's a case in St. Paul where the firefighters and the policemen have been paid their benefits over a period of time, and something like 900 of these employees are being forced to pay back $60,000 into the retirement account. This is after they've received their benefits. And another 500 and some are being forced to pay back $42,000 to the retirement account because of a so-called error in distribution of those funds. Because somebody just happened to notice that the funds were drying up. And so now they're going to attempt to collect this large amount of money from these poor retirees. Clearly, the system is collapsing that we live in. And it's financially collapsing. We have totally incompetent people running the show. And then, of course, couple in greed, big business, and what I call the last grab, the big businesses and individuals grabbing for whatever they can out of this system. And there's no other way that it's going to go but in total collapse. Of course, the worldwide economy is showing that, but I try and stay away from economic issues. But I thought it interesting that retirees are being forced to pay back money in very large amounts. I mean, you could buy an extremely nice automobile, in some places even a house, for the amount of money that these poor retirees are being forced to pay back. Let's see if I quick go through my list of articles here. Okay, I'm going to leave that till next week. Jupiter losing its band, that's going to be the top article, so I'm going to pull that article out. I talked about the scientists who are estimating that the amount of oil leaking is very far over the NOAA estimate. And let me just recap that. The government estimate of the oil spilling into the Gulf of Mexico as the official government estimate was put forth by NOAA, the same people that talk about weather, the same people that predict hurricanes based on totally fictitious factors, the same people who do not tell you when tornadoes are coming into an area because they don't understand that tornadoes are driven by electrical currents from outer space and have nothing to do with the factors they have in their computer design system. It's the same incompetent group of people, but putting out a statistic that 5,000 gallons or barrels of oil are spilling into the Gulf of Mexico when other scientists are saying that it's more like 15 times that, 80,000 barrels per day, which is it's a lot of oil. When you do that on a daily basis for weeks and weeks on end and are unable to cap that, as I said, a worldwide disaster in the making. Okay, I'm going to go into the topic of Jupiter. Jupiter, of course, is a beautiful planet. We've called it a planet for a long time. Interestingly enough, the planet Pluto, about a year or 2 years ago, lost its status as a planet, leaving us with only 8 planets. Well, I would like to remove Jupiter, actually probably Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune as planets also. They are more like small star-like objects, but especially Jupiter, and actually Saturn. Saturn is much more star-like in many properties than even Jupiter. But the point is that Jupiter clearly is not what we would call a planet, something you'd go walk on. To me, a planet is some place where you could eventually go and walk around the surface and land and do something useful, or a moon. But Jupiter is not that way. It's very much a star-like object, and that's something I recognized very early on in my work. But at any rate, Jupiter has bands. When you look at the planet, they're like different colored bands that circle the globe. And Jupiter is spinning actually very fast. It rotates on its axis about once every 10 hours. For a planet that size, that's moving pretty fast. But understand, that's the cloud tops. That is the upper cloud tops that we see. We're not really familiar with what is down below there. Somewhere down there, it's estimated there might be a surface of frozen methane, but scientists really don't know. Just to give you a scale of the size of the planet Jupiter, and this is in terms of diameter, and that is the distance from, if you looked at from the side, let's say the Sun, if you put the Sun, Jupiter, and Earth, and you just looked at the disks, the round disks from a distance, and you looked at the Sun, and let's say the Sun was 100 feet high on our scale, and Jupiter would be 10 feet high on that same scale, and Earth would be 1 foot high. So it's 100 to 10 to 1 ratio, about, more or less. And that's kind of an approximation, but it gives you a feel for the size of the Sun, Jupiter, and Earth. And of course, the Sun is fairly distant from us, but still provides us with the energy we need on a daily basis. Jupiter, interestingly enough, occasionally interacts with Earth. The military, in fact, back in the 1990s, I believe it was, noticed that Earth had taken a very large electrical discharge from Jupiter. They did not know why this happened or what caused it, the physical properties of the solar system that would cause Jupiter, but they recognized that Jupiter had discharge created a very large electrical discharge, and they even knew what kind of an electrical discharge. It was a current of electrons that interacted with Earth coming from Jupiter. And so I'll be explaining a little bit about how that works and why that can happen. But yes, Jupiter does interact with Earth as it does with all the other planets. The electrical size of a planet or object in the solar system is much different than its physical size. We look at a planet or a comet, for example, and we say, okay, that's what we see. And so in the past, people have talked about that being the size of the planet or the object. But the electrical size is something very different. Let's take a small comet, for example. Many small comets have overall size maybe, let's say, 100,000 miles across. This would be a relatively small comet. And, okay, so this comet, 100,000 miles across, maybe, you know, 300,000, 400,000, 500,000 mile tail, half a million miles. In an outer space, that's these are relatively small distances. But now let's look at the electrical size. The electrical size could span 20 or 30 million miles. These are the electrical discharges that pass through the comet from the sunward side, going out through the comet tail and going out radially outward in the solar system. So the electrical size of the comet could be 10 to hundreds of millions of miles, whereas the physical size is in terms of hundreds of thousands of miles. So the point is that electrical size is very different from physical size, and therefore if you have the right equipment, you can detect these electrical effects. And I've said before, this is the basis for all of the work that I've done on solar system electrodynamics, that the sun has an excess current of positive charge, and it does not keep this up forever. There are return currents that keep this circuit going, but this is a result of the fusion, the surface fusion of the sun. And yes, the surface of the sun is where the fusion exists, not in its core, another basic error of modern astrophysics. But at any rate, it's an electrical fire that takes place up at the surface of the star. But at any rate, the point is, for dealing with Jupiter, every object, including Earth, all the planets, all of the pieces, all of the grains of dust, everything in the solar system, to a degree, is discharging that solar capacitor. And the example I always use for people who are a little bit new to this, the summertime now, so mosquito season in many parts of the country, they have a backyard, they call them a zapper. And it's an electrical device, a high voltage device with a neon light in the middle. And that neon light, of course, is to attract the little critters. Sometimes they're not so little. But they fly in through a grounded mesh screen on the outside. So if you touch it, it's grounded. You're not going to get electrocuted or shocked. But as the bug flies in, he encounters a very high electric field, and that electric field discharges. It always discharges along the path where the bug is, and zap, and makes that zapping sound, and the bug falls down into a little tray dead. A lot of electrical energy passing through that bug. And so that's a very good example. Even PhD scientists with a degree in plasma physics could even understand that. And this is something that I try and bring to the public, because the public can understand too. It's not like the way a lot of scientists want it. They want you to think that they're smart and you're dumb and you just have to listen to what they say because they're smart and they're right. But that's not really the case. People can understand this. It's very basic. And that's the way the solar system works. That's the way Earth weather works. If you look in my weather book, it explains that Earth's weather is driven by electrical conditions in the solar system. And you can predict these. They're very predictable and many times based on planetary electrical alignments, of which Jupiter would be one of those planets. So let's just take an example. All of these objects are discharging the solar capacitor. Their electrical size, that line of current that stretches out from the sun out to the planet and out beyond, millions, hundreds, tens of millions of miles many times, as in the case with Jupiter, that electrical current is always there. So when little Earth comes around in its orbit between Jupiter and the sun, or Mars, or Venus, or Mercury, we cut through that electrical path, and if we connect into it, if the solar conditions are right, it can connect with our own electrical current and give us a little zap, just like the mosquito. So it shouldn't be too much of a great surprise to the mill boys out there that this kind of activity can happen. But of course, in the standard science world, such things cannot exist. So these types of data are simply swept under the rug. So what does this have to do with Jupiter losing its band? Well, actually, the structure of Jupiter is very complex. It involves gravity, involves electricity and magnetic coupling. It involves upward currents and venting of chemicals, which are coming from deep down in the planet, and we don't really know the source of those. You would like to think that maybe there were chemical volcanoes down there, so to speak, that were belching this material up, some kind of a cyclic engine. But the cloud tops of Jupiter are filled with chemicals of various types, very basic chemicals, but very visible from Earth. We have very easily detected the various types of chemicals in Jupiter. By the way, the Great Red Spot just happens to be adjacent to this band, this equatorial band that went away. And so when we say the equatorial band disappeared, what does that really mean? Does that mean that there was a physical structure lost on Jupiter? Well, not really. What it means is that, first of all, a cloud layer above that of some other chemicals could have come up and covered it over. Or the source of material that darkened that band in the first place has been somehow short-circuited down deeper in the atmosphere. The properties of these venting systems, these upward currents, is very much unknown. So what I'll do is go through the gravity system, the electrical system, and the magnetic coupling system, and the upward venting system, just to give you an idea of how complicated this object is that we call Jupiter. But first of all, what is the Great Red Spot? It's a cyclonic storm. It's like a hurricane, basically stretched out. When we see a hurricane on Earth, we see basically a nice, typically a nice round center, or they're stretched out a little bit sometimes when the mill boys are manipulating them, because they drag them with using the electric fields. But at any rate, a typical hurricane is very symmetric, round, a roundish storm. But on Jupiter, the Great Red Spot, a vast hurricane in the atmosphere, is stretched out. So it gets this elongated effect, and plus the bands, bands that are adjacent to the red spot are moving in opposite directions. So that kind of relative to the Great Red Spot. So that kind of stretches it out and causes the wind on one side to go radially around the planet, and the winds on the far side of the Great Red Spot to go radially the other way around the planet. So there's a lot of stretching and pulling that goes on to cause the Great Red Spot to be kind of elongated as it moves around the planet. So the question is, what is really going on? Did the band disappear, or are we just seeing more lighter colored aerosols coming up to actually cloud the southern equatorial belt? And I don't think scientists, in fact, I'm not sure what might be happening there. It's very hard to say, because we do not have a good handle on the dynamics of the atmosphere of Jupiter. What's down there? What's causing these chemicals to be belched up into these belts in the very upper atmosphere of Jupiter? But the other thing is that the loss or the changing of the belts in Jupiter's atmosphere changes. These changes occur on a regular basis. These have been seen many times before. It's unusual to see the major belt, like the southern equatorial belt, just disappear in a matter of a few days. But these belts come and go regularly. They've seen new little spots develop on the planets and go away. So those type of activity, it's a dynamic planet. It's changing. It's not going to be the same all the time. And if we could go back thousands of years, if we had equipment and had a better track record, remember that we've only been able to see the bands on Jupiter and study them for a very short time astronomically. This has been just a very short time relative to the entire lifetime of Jupiter. So if you were here a million years ago, what would Jupiter have looked like? Would there have been a red spot? What caused that red spot to start rotating and developing? And by the way, you can also carry an analogy over from Earth-like tornadoes, or tornadoes, cyclonic storms, hurricanes, etc. When a hurricane is over the ocean, it's driven by the electrical currents coming from the ionosphere. The cloud tops connect up into the ionosphere. The electrical currents start to flow. The explanation for this is well documented in my weather book, the Principia Meteorologia, the Physics of Sun-Earth Weather, written for the general public. So you can understand how these weather systems work and how NOAA and the other weather agencies and the NASA and all the other government alphabet soup agencies with their fleets and fleets of PhD scientists are still talking about warm water causing these storms, which is absolutely absurd. But be that as it may, the point is that what causes a hurricane to lose energy? Well, when a hurricane is out at sea, it typically can gain energy, but there's nothing really to dampen out its energy. When the hurricane finally reaches shore, that electrical circuit that is maintained between the ocean, right at the ocean surface level, the air right above the ocean surface, and the upper ionosphere, that electrical connection starts to transfer over to the land, and the land is a good absorber of electrical currents, so the storm actually begins to short out electrically. And so the situation on Jupiter, however, with the Great Red Spot, is that there is no land barrier. There is no continent that it's going to hit. So it just keeps going around and around and around. If we had, for example, a region through the center of, say, Central America, where hurricanes could pass through, where there was no land, then, and there was no shallow terrain underneath the ocean, the hurricanes would just keep going. They would just keep going west. Typically, they start to veer north or in other directions once they start hitting the shallows on the western side of the Atlantic Ocean. And then once they start hitting land, that's when they short out. I always got a kick out of this one weather reporter. He was telling about the vast mountains in Yucatan that stopped this one hurricane. I'm sure this guy's never been to the Yucatan because it's one of the flattest places on the planet Earth. But he was just telling everybody how those big mountains in Yucatan were just stopping that big hurricane right there. I just about had to fall off my chair and pick myself up when I heard that one. But you hear everything from scientists that have no clue what they're talking about. This is what's distributed to the general public, and really that's one of the great reasons I do this show, is to keep the public somewhat informed of what's really going on here. Okay, but with the Great Red Spot on Jupiter, there is no landmass, there's no continent down deep below it to short out that storm, so it just keeps going around and around and around. Some of the smaller storms are probably not as well connected, so they can come and go more easily. But the Great Red Spot, now how could that Great Red Spot get started? Well, gee, that could go back to a time when Venus, this great comet that came into the solar system that the ancients saw, they actually saw it interacting electrically with Jupiter. That's when they first saw Venus, the great comet, coming into the solar system. It was born of Zeus, if you remember, Venus. And that could have been a time when a massive electrical discharge between the comet and Jupiter kicked off the Great Red Spot. And so maybe it's a remnant of that particular era in cosmic history. Hard to say. We don't have data, but it would be my best candidate for where the red spot came from. And that's much like on Earth. You need a source for that initial electrical discharge to get that cyclonic motion going, to draw the ions from deep in the atmosphere, to draw them up quickly and start that vortex motion. And once it's moving, then it connects into the outer into outer space. So the red spot is electrically connected into outer space, and that's what continues to drive it. And of course, as I said, there's nothing to stop it. So it's a momentum energy system that just keeps moving, and energy is pumped into it daily as the bands, as I said, the bands on the northern and southern side of the red spot keep driving it, keep pushing energy into it from that side also, from the sides of the storm, keep it rotating as it moves around planet Jupiter. But the reason I'm making a big deal out of the Great Red Spot is because, as I said, it was bordered by the southern equatorial belt, which has now disappeared. So let me go into a little bit of detail on Jupiter. What are the bands? Well, the bands are chemicals. What you see visually are chemicals, light and dark color chemicals, that are in the atmosphere. We call them aerosols. And so they color certain regions, and they stretch out and rotate around the planet. So that's basically what you're seeing, just different chemicals that are in the rotating bands. Now, the bands move in opposite directions. So I'm just looking at a picture of Jupiter right now. And in short, you could count probably a dozen major bands on the planet Jupiter going in opposite directions. One will go one direction, one will go relatively in the other direction as the planet Jupiter spins. We know that Jupiter interacts electrically with some of the moons. Io, the closest big moon, has a tremendous electrical activity going on with Jupiter. In fact, it's probably one of the big driving systems of the magnetic field of Jupiter. So the bands also are not just chemicals in wind streams. They are in fact related to electrical conditions, because in those upper atmospheres, just like on Earth, the atmosphere has charged particles or electron streams, and those move in counter rotating directions and couple with the outer magnetic field of Jupiter. Jupiter has a tremendous magnetic field, but it doesn't have a core necessarily. There might be some magnetic field contribution that comes from its core, but some of it at least is coming from the upper atmosphere. And that's true in the case of Earth, whereas, for example, Earth, we have a permanent magnetic field that's in the rock, in the surface of the Earth, and the crust. Then it's coupled to the ionospheric electrical currents, which is coupled to the magnetic fields that are outside of Earth, the plasma rotating currents, which includes the Van Allen belts and the other plasma sheets that flow around Earth, which also, by the way, is driven by the electrical currents from the sun. It all is powered from the sun. But Jupiter, more than likely, has much of the magnetic contribution from the ions and electrons in the upper atmosphere, which are counter-rotating, coupled together to the electrons going one way, the protons and ions moving the other way, to couple to make a fairly significant magnetic field around the planet Jupiter. So these are coupled together. So not only is it a nice, pretty picture of chemicals flowing around in the atmosphere of Jupiter, it is a picture of electrical activity, which is coupled with magnetic activity, which couples to the outer space. And then we have the venting, this chemical activity that is coming up from below. Now, Jupiter is a star-like entity. So let me go into that. So there's actually a fifth property here. And it was actually measured when the early Voyager spacecraft first went by Jupiter. The Voyager spacecraft went by Jupiter, and they were able to detect protons coming up off the surface of Jupiter. The spacecraft went by, and for some unknown reason, which was actually very predictable, there was a proton or a series of positively charged particles that constantly emanates from the planet Jupiter. There were many other star-like properties like lightning and excess heat coming out of the atmosphere, indicating that there was some type of heat source in Jupiter. Now, Jupiter has an atmosphere that is almost identical with that of the Sun in chemical composition. In terms of its overall chemical composition, it is almost identical with the Sun, which would lead one to believe that they were the original pair, the original star pair of the solar system, and everything else in the solar system, or pretty much everything else, was captured at a later date, including the outer major planets. So this is a big change. Of course, this is the basis for my scientific work that once again is from the 1970s. But the point is that if you look at how the solar system really works, it doesn't have anything to do with what you would read in a modern astronomy textbook that you would see in a college classroom or in graduate school or in high school, wherever you happen to see the trickle-down information from the standard scientific community. So at any rate, let's just take one of these. I'll just explain some of the properties, just a few examples to give you an idea of how complicated this is. Okay, so gravity, first of all. Okay, imagine you're at the equator on Jupiter, moving around. Every 10 hours, you make a complete circle around the planet. You're moving around, and just imagine that. That is much faster than, let's put it this way, it's a much different period than an orbital period. In other words, the atmosphere has a different period of rotation than a particle in orbit around Jupiter. So there has to be some forces in that atmosphere to keep those outer gaseous particles locked into a rotational pattern with that atmosphere that's moving around the planet Jupiter. So there are some forces involved. Now let's go off the equator to the northern direction. And something else actually happens. Those particles are moving around in a band, and the way we see them is if you took a globe and you could take slices perpendicular to the vertical direction. In other words, as you look at it, it looks like a globe with circles drawn around it, parallel circles, up and down, up all the way to the pole. But if you're a particle in that atmosphere, that's not the way you want to go. Your orbital interest or your orbital dynamics would want you to pull in towards the equator. So there are all types of forces acting on these outer atmospheric aerosol particles just from a gravity point of view. Let's look at electricity. Okay, electricity is a much more powerful force when you're dealing with ions and small particles like electrons and ions and dust, aerosols, small chemical, molecules. So the electrical forces are the things, the forces that keep those bands in their rotational consistency. They keep the bands looking like bands. So it's the electrical force basically overpowering the gravitational force in the upper atmosphere that keeps those bands in a river-like flow pattern around the planet. And as I said, then those electrical currents couple together to make a magnetic field, which then couples with the outside world, the outside outer space region around Jupiter. And then also coupled with this, as I said, the upward venting of chemicals that comes up from below. We also see this, by the way, in Saturn. Saturn is a very star-like object. But it's interesting to see that Saturn puts out about three times as much energy as it receives from the Sun. Now, if you look at what standard science would call the energy balance of the planet, you would see that you could calculate easily the amount of sunlight, solar energy in the terms of visible light and infrared, ultraviolet, etc., that would hit the planet. You can calculate that fairly easily. And then you determine that Jupiter, Saturn, those planets out there are putting out a lot more heat than they receive from the sun. So where is that coming from? There has to be fusion-like properties in those planets, because chemical reactions just wouldn't last that long. Chemical reactions tend to burn up very quickly, especially in a free environment like that. So it's not chemical. It's the only possible source is nuclear, which tells us that Jupiter and Saturn are very much little stars and should really be taken off the planetary list, which would get us down to not eight, not seven, but six planets. And I would question Uranus and Neptune, but for sure Jupiter and Saturn should not be classified as planets. Certainly not a place you'd go walk around and wear a spaceship and a spacesuit and explore it. Very much star-like objects. So I would call Jupiter the twin star of our system. And of course, the next thing people are going to say, well, isn't there another rogue star outside of our solar system? Well, when it's discovered and an orbit established, then you might be able to claim that. But the other point there is that, just drifting off into the topic of Planet X, that there are thousands, possibly tens of thousands of large objects out there in our solar system, many of them possibly on rogue orbits that could come into the inner solar system and affect Earth. There is not just one Planet X object out there, and there's so much misinformation on that topic, it's just mind-boggling, the number of Johnny-come-lately wannabe people trying to make claims about Planet X. And the reality is that there's many, many of them, and even NASA had to admit that publicly. So at any rate, the overall situation with Jupiter, it's a dynamic planet. It's going to change, it's going to lose bands, and it's going to have bands reappear. Maybe not exactly as they were before. The band being lost issue is something rather common. It's not that unusual. The issue with electrical systems in the solar system all being driven by our sun, that's something that you can't say that Jupiter is simply an electrical system. It's not. It's very complicated, very complex. It interacts electrically with its moons. It interacts gravitationally with its moons. And it very much interacts electrically with the rest of the solar system. So there's a good deal of material pouring into the Jupiter system from beyond, because it acts like a large comet also. So at any rate, just in summary, the idea that Jupiter is dynamic is, I guess, the key issue here. That it is it's going to change. The Great Red Spot will probably be around for quite a while, but it potentially could short out at some point, or lose energy, or gain energy. It could become bigger. But it seems that the size of the Great Spot is limited by the amount of room it has as it moves between those two counter-rotating bands on each side of the Great Red Spot. I'm going to take the last couple minutes here to for the last few shows, I've really not talked about the water filters. I'm just going to very briefly talk about the state of the world. I'm personally just a little bit worried at the current condition of the world. And I was talking with some friends this week, and we made a comment, and I think kind of agreed on it, that people are prepared, they think, but if there's a major upheaval of some kind on this planet, whether man-made, whether it's economic, or if something major happens, say a major volcano goes off, the oil spill becomes a worldwide disaster, they can't cap it, and it just sits there for years and years pumping oil into the world's oceans. Being prepared is something that I think some people may think they are prepared, but how many people are really prepared for the lights to turn off, the electricity to go away, the water coming in off the city line, or the electricity is off so the well doesn't work? How many people are really prepared for that and then able to provide food for themselves for a long period of time? And And not only that, that's just the basics. How about psychological preparation? Being able to deal with all of the things that would be going on during this time when massive amounts of people were struggling just for basic survival, let alone to, going in your car, or going someplace, or getting gas. All of those things would simply be out of the question. Or if the goofy people running this planet decide to get stranger and start bringing military troops. All of these things are possible, but the issue with preparation, they're all basically the same. And the question is, can you take care of yourself? And the one thing that mostly all of us agree on also is that you're not going to be able to go anyplace. If you have to go down, get in your car, or walk down the street to get basic supplies, you're going to be in big trouble. So that's why I just go for the basics. And that's why on the webpage I have the water filters, Dalton water filters, and the flax. The flax is an amazing item. Something that's very easy to have in your house or at your cabin or wherever you might consider a safe place. A case of flax seed, this is 4 gallons in a case, $130. Plus, I had to include shipping. At first, I had free shipping, and that was kind of a disaster because shipping for this is very expensive. So, basically, if you mail order, send about $40 extra, and on the average, that would cover shipping of a case of flaxseed. The flaxseed itself, $130, add another $40 for shipping. And one case of flaxseed would be enough for one person, basically, for 1 year of basic survival food. And the ancients used to consider flax not only medicinal, but something you could, a main source of protein, of oils, of other vitamins and minerals. And then, of course, you would add to that so that you would have basic sustenance. But the water filters, still $289 for the stainless steel unit, comes with 4 filters, the free Kato WRX-911 radio, and that has free shipping still to the 50 states, the Dalton water filter. And let me just give out the mail order address, something I failed to do for quite a few weeks. JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota, 55392. Once again, JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota, 55392. That's 130 plus 40, so 170 for the flax, $289 for the Dalton water filter. I would say those are your requirements. Without those, you're not going to be doing very well. And I'm out of time. I'm ending just 1 minute early due to the frequency change. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.